Hello, and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, SW Conser, and today we are live in the studio, and it's a packed house in here. Around the table, we have a number of celebrated authors and artists, all of whom are participating in a big event this weekend at the University of Oregon's Portland campus, White Stag Auditorium. It's called Underground USA, and it's a tribute to the heady days of alternative media and cartooning here in Portland. First of all, let's welcome back to the show local comics artist and illustrator David Chelsea. David, good to see you again.
Delighted to be here.
And we also have Patrick Rosenkranz here. Patrick is a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and a comics historian. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
And a fellow who needs very little introduction, Norman Solomon is a writer and media critic, as well as a recent candidate for California's 2nd Congressional District. He's the founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy and active with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Norman, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thanks. Very glad to be here.
David, Ann Richardson of the Oregon Cartoon Institute has been coordinating this event, Underground USA. What can you tell our listeners about what's going to happen this Saturday?
So it is a kind of a symposium with panels and I think a final grand panel discussion about the basically about Portland's early underground newspapers, the Willamette Bridge and the Portland Scribe, and how they intersected with comics and how they provided an inspiration to some of the artists who worked there, including myself, and Bill Plimpton, who is another panelist.
Bill Plimpton is coming into town tomorrow. He'll be at Saturday's event. Critic Richard Gere is on board, and so is historian Maurice Isserman. I believe local comics journalist Joe Sacco is going to be part of the event, but haven't found out whether that's true or not. That would be great.
Well, I don't think he's officially on the schedule, but he's certainly welcome to join us.
Okay. Well, let's not forget about the audience, too. We're going to have a lot of distinguished people in the audience, educators, cartoonists, critics, all kinds of people.
Yes, and of course, concomitant with this symposium is the Comic City USA exhibit at the Oregon Historical Society that has some great great historical folks in it. You know, I mean, I'll mention, I'd like to point out, by the way, speaking of history, that all three of you, David, Patrick, and Norman, have a history with KABU. David, you've done radio theater. Patrick, I believe you've co-hosted a show having to do with comics.
Underground Comics Underground Radio comics. Zine with Matt Clark.
Yes. And Norman, you were here in the early 70s, actually on the board of directors.
Right. Yes, it was a wonderfully chaotic creative time, administratively and otherwise.
Right. Well, so we're mostly going to be talking about newspapers. Does everybody remember newspapers? I mean, print media. This was this seems to be a thing. Nowadays, alternative weekly papers have sort of evolved into lifestyle magazines. But back then, this was the way to get actual grassroots news out that wasn't being covered in the major mainstream corporate newspapers.
Yeah, they call them dead tree editions now.
Well, you know, it's I've struck by a culturally now, it's like because the mass culture has morphed into selling things, parts of it are very palatable now. Like, I mean, no offense to anybody who might be listening or not, but when I was living in Portland, I mean, we considered Willamette Week to be, you know, just hopeless. And now it's like sort of, okay, now marijuana's happening, so we're very countercultural. But the segue and the intersection in with just selling a lot of things is so clearly at the core, which at its best, you know, the so-called underground papers that we were part of in some way, we weren't into particularly selling things other than maybe concepts, attitudes, whatever.
Advertising.
Well, the advertising department seemed to be a poor relation, at least at the Scribe, because what I remember is that the Scribe was continually mounting appeals to its readers to support us and bail us out and save us. And it didn't seem like the advertising was quite doing it.
I'll jump in here. And this is before my time here in Portland, but there were two underground newspapers that are sort of being spotlighted at this event at Underground USA. And the first one to be published was the Willamette Bridge, starting in 1968. And that was, Patrick, you were part of the Willamette Bridge crew. And after that was the Portland Scribe, which was from the early 70s for a few years after that. And David, you and Norman were part of that.
Yes, but I don't remember Norman, and no, I doubt he remembers me.
I was going to say, I was very much just freelance, and as I remember, there was an office on Belmont at one point.
There was an office on Belmont, and then it was at Centenary Wilbur on 9th and Ash.
I might have spent a few minutes in there handing in, and of course, we always handed in hard copy, then that's all there was, but I would be handing in articles is all I know. But I was so gratified they actually would publish what I wrote. It was amazing.
Now, it sounds like, Patrick, the Willamette Bridge, the earlier publication, was a little bit more political, maybe a little bit more doctrinaire, and the Scribe was maybe a little bit more socially active, but some good artistic content as well?
Well, I'm actually remembering the Scribe as being pretty doctrinaire. Okay. I never worked at the Willamette Bridge. I used to read it, and I used to mostly read it for the comics. They would carry Crumb, and they would carry the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers and some other stuff that was Ron Cobb. They would carry a lot of stuff that was in syndication. I don't remember homegrown cartoonists doing comics for the Bridge. I do remember that Hank Pander did illustrations for them, did a couple of covers.
Mostly for that theater group he was working with.
Uh-huh.
Which Penny Allen was part of, and I believe actually later on Gus Van Sant and Eric Edwards became part of that,
yes,
that crew as well. So yeah, this really ties into a huge history of the whole budding art scene back in the day. There's also, you know, I mean, some of that same crew did this TV series that's going to be playing tomorrow evening at the Film Center, which is called Pillars of Portland. So let's talk about, first off, Willamette Bridge. Tell us about the political and the artistic content of that, Patrick.
Well, they had a lot to do with the street people, too. I mean, we relied on them to sell the newspaper. So every Friday morning, dozens of people would show up at the office and pick up a stack of Willamette Bridge and go out on a street corner or go out to the freeway ramps and sell them. And that was the primary source of income other than advertising. I was hired in 69 to be the advertising director, so that's where I came in and helped them raise their budget and provide more money for facilities and print runs and whatnot.
So you were looking for a niche for an underground...
I wanted to work in the counterculture. I did not want a straight job.
Uh-huh. And so you did find a niche for people who actually wanted to pay money to have their ads run in the Willamette Bridge in this alternative paper that was scraping by.
That's right. Goose Hollow Inn was one of the main subscribers, a number of bookstores, any kind of hippie shop like Black and White Records, Millennium, Music Millennium. There were leather shops, there were people making jewelry. But then I got the dirty bookstores to advertise. They were called Yellow Fronts back then. There were a number of them around town with bright yellow forefronts. And I brought in a great advertising contract with them that looked like it was going to really finance the newspaper well. But, you know, that was my first mistake. My first counter-revolutionary error was to bring in this sexist material. So, you know, I won't name names, but one of the women who worked on the paper said, "My mother and my aunt in Boston read this paper, and I cannot have them see this advertisement." I said, "This is an underground newspaper. Have you seen the Berkeley Barb? Have you seen the East Village Other?" Alas.
So, David, tell us about some of your time on the Portland Scribe.
Well, I was in high school at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
And I came in and volunteered. Actually, the first job I was given was proofreading, and that's when I learned that there's no apostrophe in the possessive it. Somebody had to school me. But I mostly wanted to do illustrations, and really what I wanted to do was get comics in. So I very patiently and as professionally as I could accepted the assignments that came my way to draw evil CIA agents and heroic freedom fighters, all, you know, with the idea that I would get comics into the paper. And, you know, eventually...
Know your audience.
Yes. Eventually, editorial relented and gave me a full page every week for About 7 weeks. And then there was a collective meeting, and my strip was voted out of existence.
You had, I believe you were offered $5 for an illustration and $10 for a cover illustration.
Yeah, so. my memory's cloudy on that point. It might have been more for a cover, but there's actually an illustration that I'm going to show in my presentation in which I signed it David Chelsea $5. So that's historical documentation.
Well, $5 was a lot more money back in 1970.
And of course, I was, you know, a high school kid living at home, so the money was just gravy. You know, I think I went out and bought records with it.
So Bill Plimpton was also part of the Portland Scribe at the time. He was doing comics. He's out of PSU. He was doing comics for Playboy and other magazines.
He actually moved to New York City in 1968.
Oh, okay.
So he was mailing it in.
Ah, okay.
And he did. I don't know exactly how the connection was made with him, but he did at least one cover, a few illustrations, and he had a strip running regularly for, you know, like 5 weeks. For some reason, continuing comic strips did not last long at the Scribe. They tended to, you know, every year or so, one would be announced with great fanfare, you know, two episodes would run, and then you would never see it again.
So, Norman, what was your experience working with the folks here?
Well, my impression was that it was run by people who were quite responsible. I mean, compared to me, anyway.
Ah.
And older people were in charge, like maybe as high as 30 years old. And so to me, this was like
amazing.
A really establishment counterculture outlet, if that isn't an oxymoron. You know, but I never expected to be paid for anything, and I don't think I was. But I went down, for instance, and monitored the involuntary commitment hearings in Portland in the early 70s, which were horrible. People were being railroaded into mental institutions with no legal representation. So I remember I got to, you know, sit in the courtroom and write it up, and the Scribe would publish it, which, you know, keep in mind, the Oregonian was like really awful then, you know, whatever one might say now. But it was just an atrocious chamber of commerce type of sheet. So the Scribe was extremely distinguishing itself in contrast.
And you, at the same time, you're helping out at KABU, doing some reporting for them. And KABU was covering, I believe, City Hall meetings just live at the time.
Right. Actually, that was part of our service. And I believe that maybe even some money was changing hands from the city of Portland for the civic engagement of letting people hear the actual voices in real time, which, you know, was amazing in 1971. I remember these double-pronged plugs you would put in that were hot-wired from the city council chambers. And, I mean, you did get to hear what they were saying and doing, which was, you know, to our ears, fairly dismal, but at least it was some transparency.
So give us a sense of what you're going to be talking about at Underground USA on Saturday.
Ooh, well, I guess it's sort of some of the political context from my vantage point of what was going on then. I mean, this was, what was the cliche? Portland was the biggest small town in America at the point. And it was quite, the ruling circles were very conservative. It was just the big money. What did they name a square after Mayor Schrunk? Is that his name?
Terry Schrunk.
Terry Schrunk. Yeah. Yeah, it was just politically center right, if not right. And the Oregonian elites.
I believe
were there
at the time Neil Goldschmidt was mayor. From 1972. And he was considered, well, I don't know, maybe not at the Scribe, but he was considered fairly progressive, in national politics.
Not sure he came. Maybe he did come in quite that early. But when I arrived in 70, 71, the politics were very much center. Of course,
we're still talking about the Mount Hood Freeway instead of the Max.
Yes, we were fighting.
Well,
there was this guy, Ivan
Goldschmidt,
C,
was the guy
running.
That killed that.
Yes, indeed. And of course, we did support him against the city council member. I think his name was Ivan C, who wanted to build that horrible freeway through Southeast and so forth. So that was a battle. On the other hand, it should be said that there is ample evidence of the wisdom of Goldschmidt in terms of the ripping up downtown for, what, half a dozen years for the bus malls and so forth. And it turned out to be pretty visionary to my eyes. On the other hand, it was not a secret that Goldschmidt, Willamette Week, was very tight with the developers who had their eye on Northwest Portland, which became Old Town, which became whatever. So I think Goldschmidt was like a corporate liberal, you know, and he was ready for the real estate killing with his buddies. And that is what happened.
Yeah, I arrived here in the 90s, and still even then, Portland was still kind of a timber town, so that vestige of the timber baron history was really strong in the 60s and 70s still when these papers, the Willamette Bridge and the Portland Scribe, were coming out. I want to mention to our listeners, you are listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm live in the studio today with a group of artists and authors who are participating in the Underground USA Symposium this weekend at the University of Oregon's Portland campus. That's 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday. It's at 70 Northeast Cooch, so the White Stag Building. David Chelsea is with us, along with Patrick Rosencrantz and Norman Solomon. Norman, I want to mention, we were talking about comics, and one of the many, many books that you've written is called, let's see, it's The Trouble with Dilbert. It's, How Corporate Culture Gets the Last Laugh.
Yeah.
And you've been quoted as saying, I think Dilbert is the opiate of the masses.
Well, I guess I told a reporter that. I was inspired to write The Trouble with Dilbert by reading the book that was co-written by Errol Dorfman called How to Read Donald Duck.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I've got a copy of that. That was, yes.
Got in through customs, no doubt, because there was a whole lawsuit for a while.
But based on the Chilean Revolution
It was a critique that naturally, if you're going to do a criticism, you need to do a content analysis. And so they had put Disney strips in there, Donald Duck, which therefore caused the Disney Corporation to file suit, block the import of the book. It's still sort of hard to find. But that said, it was inspiring to me to then look at Dilbert and do some sort of analysis.
I'll butt in here and say quickly that Patrick Rosencrantz, his presentation on Saturday is going to be about Carl Barks and Beza Wolverton, two Northwest cartoonists. But Carl Barks drew these amazing Donald Duck adventures where he and his nephews and Uncle Scrooge would go off to these countries in the Southern Hemisphere and be looking for gold, and he'd meet these wonderful, innocent natives who would just, oh, we don't need this gold, go ahead and take it. You know, and so this Errol Dorfman book, How to Read Donald Duck, is this wonderful just critique of that whole mindset.
Yes, yeah, very, very much. And, you know, as is the case with culture in so many realms, I mean, choose any medium you want, there's the received impression that we accept, we're inured to, it's hidden in plain sight, but there's a lot of messaging that goes on, and, you know, not to be mechanical about it, but it's better to think about it than not. And I think that's what How to Read Donald Duck sort of opened up.
Well, let's point out that Walt Disney was a stool pigeon for the FBI.
Yeah.
Well, now I have to ask you, Norman, did you run into any difficulty reproducing Scott Adams strips for your book?
Well, we had a very prominent note on the cover that this book is in no way connected to the Dilbert of Scott Adams. And the way I ran into difficulty is he put me in his comic. By name, and I was denounced by name by Dogbert. And then when he did a book, when his next hardcover book devotes 8 pages to denouncing me, which I guess I take as a compliment, you know.
So
unwise to irritate cartoonists.
So, which is a quote, by the way. I'm trying to remember who it is.
Matt Groening.
Thank you very much. But tell us really quick, Norman. So the critique of Dilbert that you put into Trouble with Dilbert, How Corporate Culture Gets the Last Laugh. Tell us your critique.
Well, it was really the comic strip was aimed and is aimed at sort of middle management, and we're all stupid. And we should not band together because there's idiocy in the person at the desk next to you. And his books as well elaborate, and he has a very, you might say, libertarian philosophy. He's endorsed Donald Trump for president, by the way, Scott Adams has.
Oh, my goodness. So let's see, the event again, Underground USA, celebration of Portland's alternative press, happening this Saturday, undergroundusa.wordpress.com. Patrick, I want to ask you, you are doing, as we said, a panel on Northwest cartoonist Beza Wolverton, who's famous for his extruded characters in Mad Magazine, and I believe the character in, the very ugly character in Little Abner, Lena the Hyena, and also Carl Barks, as we mentioned, who was the good artist, as they say, on the Disney comics. So you've been writing a series of biographies of underground cartoonists. I say biographies, but they're also collections of some of their most popular work.
Anthologies as well,
right,
yes.
Right. When it comes to underground comics, some of the names our listeners might recognize are Robert Crumb, Bill Griffith, maybe Trina Robbins. Cartoonist.
Let's not mention Trina Robbins.
Okay. The cartoonists you're profiling aren't necessarily household names. Rand Holmes, Esclay Wilson, Spain Rodriguez. What's important about these particular artists?
They changed the medium forever. They brought it back to an adult audience. They broke every taboo that was set out by the Comics Code Authority. They were able to speak to a generation of people who like getting high. You know, they have a continued impact on the alternative cartoonists who follow them. So I think they're very, very important in the history of media arts. And I would say some of them are probably the most significant artists of the 20th century.
Spain Rodriguez, we've had in the studio, the late lamented Spain Rodriguez, but he's been a guest on the show. And his character Trash Man was one of the first really alternative kind of takes on a superhero, kind of the parodies of superhero, a character from the streets.
He originated in the East Village Otherworld. Spain was in New York, and it was his first big character. And he was really of the moment. He called for a revolution, armed revolution. He singled out the hierarchy of elitists who ruled things. And in the final scene in the Trash Man episode that appeared in the East Village Other, Trash Man guns down a whole ballroom full of these fat plutocrats who are eating long pig, which is human flesh.
And Rand Holmes, people around here in the States especially aren't too familiar, but in the Northwest, he really should be considered part of the Pacific Northwest canon because he was active in Vancouver, B.C. for so long.
Yes, he was probably the center of the underground press at the Georgia Strait.
Which has been going on, is still going on strong in Vancouver.
Well, it's taken the role of like the Willamette Week has. It's now an entertainment, advertising kind of thing to tell people what's happening this week and, you know. Really has nothing to do with the underground press anymore.
So Willamette Week and Mercury, they still run a few cartoons, but but not like they used to. There used to be full pages. And there were other underground and alternative newspapers here in town.
There were quite a few of them that people don't remember.
That had pages and pages of comics.
Right. There's the one right now, Vision Quest.
Right, right. That's one that you can find around at the various comic book shops and bookstores. Let's see, Paperback Jukebox was one, I believe. Anodyne.
Portland Permanent Press.
Yeah. So, let's talk a little bit more about that history. I mean, comics, you know, comics, they're said to be what people turn to first. And so why are they being bumped to the edges or the margins or bumped out completely?
Ooh.
I blame the intellectuals.
I
intellectuals
don't
like Norman?
Is it
some
fashion?
Of my best friends are intellectuals.
Because I know that alternative papers are seeing hard times just the way that daily papers are, and maybe it's just that comics are the canary in the coal mine. But it does seem like the fashion has turned against the syndicated weekly strips that had been going for 20 or more years. You know, like Life in Hell and Linda Barry's comics, and you're seeing less and less of it. A lot of people are quitting. And I'm not enough of an economic analyst to know quite why that is.
Well, you're seeing their work appear in graphic novels and being lauded in academia rather than in the newspapers.
For instance, does Tom Tomorrow run in Portland anymore?
Well, he doesn't run in the print editions. So what you get a lot these days, especially on the internet, is you get sort of separation of the print and the cartoons.
Yeah, that's a shame.
So you'll get a lot of web cartoons, but they might be separate from the print content. And so everything's sort of put in a box these days on the internet, which is funny because, of course, that was supposed to be the free-flowing streaming service we were looking forward to.
Right, right.
But Matt Boers, also a friend of the show, has been, he's in the print edition of, I believe, the Mercury every week, which is a positive step, certainly.
Well, I'm sorry that they dropped the other strips they were doing, like Kaz's Underworld and Tony Millionaire's Mackies. I used to enjoy reading those, but they're no longer in the Mercury.
Yeah, it seems like there are fewer and fewer syndicated cartoons nowadays. I think it was about the time that Matt Groening ended Life in Hell that really all of those strips are getting dropped from. There used to be hundreds of alternative papers that would run, say, Life in Hell or Ernie Pook's Comique by Linda Barry.
Yeah, and I happen to know the art director of Willamette Week, and they run a strip by a local artist who is a friend of hers. Who is not paid, and just, you know, every once in a while when they can get away with it. For years and years, the alternative papers pretty much ran the national syndicated strips and didn't really generate comics on their own. I mean, the Scribe was very brave in doing it, even though, you know, their commitment to comics was kind of spotty. But, you know, it's interesting that for a few years at least, local cartoonists like me were able to find a spot.
So what do you think killed off the Scribe, by the way? Because it only lasted a few years.
Oh, well, I know it was the IRS. Like, they hit them up for back taxes and padlocked the place.
Oh, my.
This was after I'd already moved to New York, but I've heard about it.
All right.
You didn't know this?
I was not growing up here, unlike you, but... So let's talk about your presentation that you're giving, David.
Oh, well, I'm going to be showing some early illustrations and comics from the Scribe, mine and other people's, including some of Bill's work and some really beautiful work.
Sharon Nimchuk is in there as well?
Sharon, as far as I know, she only ever did one strip, and it's in the presentation. Also some really lovely stuff by an artist named Bob Reaney, who lives in Seattle now.
Bob Reaney, a good friend he's one of the friends of the NIB up in Seattle, which is a collective of cartoonists that includes Jim Woodring. So that's a great group of folks. So this is an event called Underground USA. It's a celebration of Portland's alternative press, happening this Saturday, October 15th at University of Oregon's Portland campus, 70 Northeast Cooch Street. Tell us about David. Give us more of a rundown of what's going on here. Again, we're going to have some other folks that are coming into town, such as Richard Gere. And
Richard Gere is coming in, and he's moderating the panel. He has a history with the Portland Scribe. He sold it on the street. He was a Scribe newsboy, along with his best high school friend Matt Groening. And what I've heard is that Gere did it for a while. Groening did it for one afternoon. He said, "This is not for me."
And now he's a well-known historian and author and critic, so yes. that's a good group. Bill Plimpton's going to be in town. He's also doing a screening at the Mission Theater. Mm-hmm. So here's your chance to come and see some of his animated shorts and find out about his cartoons, his print cartoons.
Yes, and I know Maurice Isserman is coming. Yes. He was a mainstay of the Scribe for a long, long time. I don't think he had much intersection with the comics, so I don't know if he'll be talking about that, but probably he'll be talking about how awesome the Scribe was.
Well, you can find out more by going to undergroundusa.wordpress.com. We've been joined by David Chelsea, Patrick Rosencrantz, and Norman Solomon. They'll all be participating this weekend. David, Patrick, Norman, thanks for joining us on Words and Pictures.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to a two-way conversation with the audience as well, not just a presentation from us to them.
And quickly, let's go around the table and find out how people can find out more about you and your various books and projects.
Oh, Norman. I guess on the web at normansolomon.com.
Okay, and David?
dchelsea.com, as well as you can check out my continuing webcomic, Are You Being Watched, on Patreon, and also Tumblr, watchcomic.tumblr.com.
And Patrick?
Well, there is patrickrosencrantz.com, but I'd like to give a shout-out to Fantagraphic Books, publisher of the world's greatest cartoonists and preserving all the work from the cartoon's history.
Well, good. You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/Words and Pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.